be emotional about that mission and vision, and be really rational about how you get there, right? Be really rational about the inputs that are changing constantly, that you need to pivot and move things around.
Yo, all righty, guys. Greetings and welcome to the first episode in season 2 of Too Rare to Live, Too Rare to Die. We're kicking off the show with Matt Allen, superstar and CEO of Tractor Ventures, a revenue-based finance business that helps founders create a future state that they can control. It's very different from how the world thinks about financing and growth. Think a tractor, not a rocket, a horse, and not a unicorn. Along with deep experience in startups and financing, Matt has made some successful investments, including Mr. Yum, Linktree, and Spaceship, to name a few. He believes in providing the option and flexibility for founders to get revenue-based financing without the pressure of growing on steroids, a deliberate sort of growth that you can control. Today's conversation is about keeping balance and control for founders who are ambitious and yet cautious about growing their startups. Before we get into it, you guessed it, here is a word from our sponsor.
A brilliant startup like yours needs the best of the best on your team. Are you taking advantage of global talent? Level up your team for more success for only 33% of your usual hiring costs. Go to www.athena.io/rare right now to learn more. That's www.athyna.io/rare.
Welcome to Too Weird to Live, Too Rare to Die, a podcast telling the stories of founders, investors, and operators working to turn the world we live in into a better place. Matt Allen, Tractor Ventures, start mate, XAWS. Hey, mate, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Cool. So, Matt, we actually have a tradition here at Too Rare to Die where Wallo will open us up with a song that he's prepared specifically just for you. So here you go.
Yeah. Have you been sung to before?
No, Wallo, this is number one.
Typical answer.
Yeah. I hope I can make this one special. So yeah, I will share some music, share some lyrics, you know, so that you can, you know, follow me as I rip along. Yeah, so. Okay, so. Have a nice beat there. Intro. Yeah, I picked you to be an R&B, oldies R&B guy. So yeah. Take a breath for a minute. Hustling is hard. It's hard. It's here taking your business. Can it help you grow? Help you grow. What's the matter? What's the matter? What's the matter? Look for matter. What's the matter? What's the matter? What's the matter? Look for matter. What's the matter? What's the matter? What's the matter? Look for matter. What's the matter? What's the matter? Yeah, hope you enjoyed that. That was my
thanks, Wallo.
Nice. Yes. What's the matter? Look for matter. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Nice. Hey, so that's super funny. Before we get into your background, Matt, it's pretty cool. I think you and Lucas were in the exact same role at AWS potentially. Some, like both in startups, right? Lucas, is that fair?
Yeah, I pretty similar. I was a startup account manager, but I know that Matt, maybe you were business development, like similar space working with startups. But yeah, those roles worked really, really close. So that's amazing.
The key differentiator is that I didn't have a dollars attached to my goal. So I was not a sales guy. I was able to put my hand on my heart and say, I'm not here to sell you anything. I just want to help you, you know, build a better business.
where my Lucas here has some like he should use more cloud.
Lucas was closing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's it. I open them up and these guys close them. That's exactly right.
That's true. And when I find out about that role, I said, oh man, I really like that, like developing the network, the community of startups. So yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, one of my favorite things was down here in Australia. I just used to put lunches on for founders. I'm like, cool, like we're not here to see anything. I just want you guys to meet each other. And some of the connections that we're able to build in a pure BD, you know, a lot of the time it was just making sure these founders were able to talk to other founders who were, you know, in a similar boat, growing really quickly, shit's breaking all over the place. And, you know, and that, you know, being able to sort of hover around at a high level and connect these founders up, you know, as part of your job, is like, that's a pretty damn good job. As I've always said, as far as jobs go, it was a pretty damn good job.
Yeah, that's true. I totally agree.
That's epic. Stripe, we'd had something very similar to Stripe. We had a business dinner once they put on for Stripe Atlas customers, and I'm still super close with a bunch of them, mentoring and helping and as allies, and it's super, super awesome. Hey, Matt, so tell us a little bit about your background. So you're pretty vast experience set. I mean, what's brought you to where you are today? Where did it all start? Where'd you grow up? Anything you want to tell us? Who's Matt Allen?
So dating myself here, you know, I grew up in using the internet in the 90s, which is right at the beginning. You know, like, you know, Netscape came out in 93. I was in 10 and I was a bit of a nerd, had computers at home. My parents, you know, made a bunch of sacrifices to buy us a computer to have at home, which was not normal, you know, in the early 90s. They were bloody expensive for regular folk. But they did that and allowed me to tinker. And mum had this one rule, which was like, you can have as much computer time as you like, as long as you're not playing games. So I'm like, cool, I'll go do other stuff. So I remember, you know, transposing, and I was playing piano then, transposing, you know, sheet music into a MIDI player, and then, you know, literally one note at a time, you know, like put note on, change note type, you know, create chords and creating things like, you know, Funky Town and stuff, you know, from playing in MIDIs on my machine. And also, you know, wrote some code and sort of taught myself to build. So, you know, I'm a self-taught builder. You know, I wouldn't call myself an engineer at all. You know, I'm certainly not qualified to call myself that, but I'm also not that from a sort of a personality perspective as well. I'm a tinkerer. I got a lot of stuff done. And my career has gone through several phases. So, you know, for the first 15 years, I was a software developer, but a self-taught software developer, mostly web. Did a lot of work for a lot of other people, made other people a lot of money, learned a bunch of stuff along the way, from, you know, web 1.0, where it was all about viewing source and copying and pasting and replicating what you could see on the screen and then modifying it. You know, it's very difficult to do that nowadays with modern technology, modern front-end JavaScript technology anyway. So, you know, being a software developer, self-taught software developer, a little bit of imposter syndrome, you know, when hanging out with like computer science guys and the ones who, you know, fundamentally know the guts of why they're doing this stuff, where I'm just like, well, it kind of worked for me, and moving on to the next thing.
The equivalent of the guys building the metaverse today.
Could have been. You know, the metaverse is probably as shaky as web 1.0 as it is, you know, in the current state in 2022. And I was always fascinated. I remember, you know, when I was just finished high school, I went and met a guy, you know, off the internet, as you do when you're 19. You know, I drove across to Bondi, and I was living out in the southwest suburbs of Sydney, and he was just an interesting dude, and he was kind of a business guy, and I went, I think I want to be a business person, and I didn't really know what that meant, and my folks are certainly not entrepreneurial, you know, they're very, very, you know, my dad worked at the water board his whole career, my mum was basically a homemaker, so there was not a lot of influence on how to do business and how to, you know, how to start things from home, but I just wanted to be that. And, you know, being a software developer, just sort of a web developer mostly, sort of allowed me to interact with a lot of business people. And there was a time around sort of 2012, 2013, where I shifted gears from being a software developer, having been a founder a few times, but the technical founder, you know, the one writing the code, to join my friend's technical recruiting company, and sort of wanted to take my mates effectively who are all software developers, because that was, you know, I used to run a bunch of software development meetups and conferences and stuff, and and help them with their career progression. So spent 4.5 years as a technical recruiter and built out some pretty large scale software engineering teams for local companies, you know, realestate.com.au and Redbubble and Jetstar and Invato and some of these really high growth, you know, companies here in Melbourne. So moved a family to Melbourne to do that. And after that went to AWS, as we've already touched upon, spent 2.5 years there and then left there to start my own thing, you know, and here we are. So, you know, the four phases, sort of software developer, technical recruiter, business development in cloud, and now back to founder again, running a finance company, and being able to help, you know, more and more founders sort of choose the way they fund their company, where, especially in Australia, where we're still within kind of cycle number one of VC, you know, the first funds aren't even at the end of their life cycle yet. So they're sort of nearly 10 years old. So, you know, in Australia, we lag a little bit behind the rest of the world when it comes to the mechanics that founders can use to bring capital into their company. So, you know, it's traditionally up until the last little while, it's been you're VC funded or you're running off your own steam and there's nothing in between. And we believe that by creating different options and different types and different shapes of capital to different founders, then, you know, people will be able to grow really successful companies, whatever their definition of success is. And hopefully we can help a bunch of them do that, you know, without necessarily putting them on the venture capital path if they don't want to, which we know that not every company is compatible with that, you know, high growth, high risk, high reward outcome. Plenty are, but plenty aren't. And the plenty that aren't, plenty of good companies, too. You know, yeah, really good company and solid companies. These are companies that may not be growing at 200-300% year on year, but still doing 100%, and given enough time, they still become really impactful businesses. You know, they may, their ownership structure might be different. The founders may own the absolute vast majority, if not all of it. And you know, the challenges they face are, you know, it's a bit isolating when you run these companies by yourself, you know. One of the things when you take VC money is you get a bunch of money, but you get a bunch of other founders who are sort of in the similar space. And the challenge when you're running a bootstrap company or a non-VC backed company is like, oh, like, who are my people? Like, where's my community live? Like, who are, there's no common bond. So Tractor Ventures was born to be able to help lots of different shape founders build different shape companies. And, you know, they're all still growing. They're all as ambitious as everyone else. They're just choosing a slightly different path. And we're at the end of year, we're at the beginning of year two now. It's been a big 2021. We launched just before Christmas 2020. So we're a year and a bit in, and it's been really a fun ride. And just learning a lot. You know, we thought we were going to build a bit of a slow burn business ourselves. That was not the case. Turns out that so it's called Tractor Ventures, and the opposite of a tractor in our world is a rocket. The VC back rockets, they're really exciting. They've got these huge missions, but they're very expensive and they're complex and they're prone to blowing up before landing, before completing the mission.
Your name's Elon Musk.
Well, he blew up. He almost tanked. Yeah, no, he did blow up a few too. Too many up as well, right? It's actually a perfect analogy. Yeah, no,
true. Very true.
Shitload of money, shitload of time, almost ran out because you blew up too many rockets. So tractors in our minds are, you know, consistent, reliable, you know, they're the workhorses. You know, they may not be as exciting to kids dreaming to be an astronaut, but, you know, without them, you know, we're all kind of screwed. So, you know, we believe that from a technology perspective, the technological tractors are the ones that are servicing their businesses, their business customers who consistently, reliably sort of rely on them to become a critical part of their business. And they just methodically get better.
Yeah. The thing that I found really interesting about Tractor Ventures and what you're up to these days is, as you said, obviously in Australia, it's the venture scene is quite new. There's obviously a handful of angel investors, and that's obviously growing as well. There are some SaaS companies doing the revenue-based financing stuff. We've actually used one of them, and it's been quite successful for us, and we've enjoyed it. But what I like about what you've done, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on why you structured it like this and the value that you think it adds, is you've nearly got the blend of the revenue-based financing, the model, holding off the dilution and so forth, but also the kind of support that you would get from a VC. Because yourself, you know, you're a very well-respected guy, like top of the top echelon, and your connections and contacts and your co-founders and so forth. So is that kind of the space you're trying to play in? Like, yeah, hold off the VCs and the dilution and so forth, or you maybe just might not have the right business model, and we're here to help, but we'll also give you that key support, like you mentioned.
Yeah, look, we're certainly not anti-VC, and the ironically is you know, our hypothesis when we started Tractor was that of the companies that are able to get RBF from us because they're growing and they've got revenue flowing for the company, some of them will just continue to be profitable companies. Some of them will go on to raise capital. And we've just done, in the first 12 months, we've done two, and I've got two more to go, you know. So the people that have backed Tractor, who are all founders themselves or ex-founders or family offices, you know, part of the reason they're here is they're like, cool, so you guys write loans and you make money on the loan. The loans basically run our company. So, the revenue from the profit from the loans run our business. And our advisory piece is basically the VC piece. You know, we they're all done as warrants or options. So it's basically we say to the founder, we would like the opportunity to buy into your company at today's price. And for that opportunity, we'll kind of throw the kitchen sink at you. And our definition of kitchen sink is our team that, you know, our full-time team, our team of ex-founders. We've also got 70 shareholders who are all founders and ex-founders who are like, yeah, we're happy to help. Like, if someone's got a specific problem, route them our way and we'll help them. So, you know, we're trying to solve those two problems. One is capital that has a certain set of expectations attached to it that's not the same as venture. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, like when you've been head down, bum up, building a company to a couple of million bucks in revenue and you haven't really been out in startup land, and a lot of them aren't because they're busy building a business, right? And they've managed to get it to millions of dollars in revenue. They're like, they get to this point and they're like, oh, I need, what do I do next? Like I'm starting to hit this next level of unknowns. And, you know, they quite often just sort of get a little bit of like, shit, I need some help. And I don't know how, because you can't take the VC playbook and plop it on a non-venture backed company, right? Because the mechanics of the business aren't shaped the same way. So you need the advice that is the correct shape for the ambition and the capitalization of that particular company. So the VC playbook's not right. You know, the standard boring advisory piece from accountants and lawyers that don't do high growth tech is not right either. And in the middle here is this sort of void of like, well, we've got this business that's growing. We've got this capital that expects growth as well, which allows us to do some more things. But what do we do? How do we do that? That's where we sit. So, you know, that's our little equity play. And when we say little equity, you know, it's 1-2%. It's not a lot, but it's at a price that's today. And we've got sort of, you know, 5 or 6 years to be able to make that decision as to whether or not we want to actually exercise the option to buy those shares. And the founders, you know, and the founders have the right to, you know, if they don't think we're adding value, they can kind of fire us. So like, we are skin in the game. Let's help.
That's great.
Yeah.
100%. So what's a typical, like, can you share some of the, like, I know it's early days, but like success stories or like, founders that you're working with, what's a, cause a lot of us do know the typical VC software, Web 3.0, you know, crypto, whatever, you know, all the most exciting and evocative words that you can throw around in startup land. That's cool. You see that, and you know, Crunchbase and TechCrunch and what, all that stuff. Like, what's a typical, who are you working with, and who can you help the most?
So the companies are typically, you know, about a million ARR as a minimum. You know, our biggest one's sort of 7 or 8 US. So like, they do scale up. So they've all got revenue flowing through them. But a lot of the time they're actually solving what looks to be a niche problem. And the problem with a lot of venture is that, you know, if it looks to be niche, but it's not, you know, you got to dive pretty deep to sort of understand what this business could look like. And, you know, we all know that the main metric for venture is growth. Like, we need you to be at $100 million plus in revenue in the next 5 or 6 years. And if you can't be, you know, it's opportunity cost. It's like, we're not saying your business is bad, but we're saying this one over here that's more likely to get there is what we need to do. So, you know, one of our portfolios, a company called Sedu, and they monitor outdoor advertising. So, you know, outdoor advertising used to be a sign on the side of the freeway, a big sign, and, you know, and the time period that sign was up was for a month. And dudes would go out there and they'd take it down and they'd put it back up again, and it's a month. With digital signage, the time period is 6 seconds rotating through 100 different advertisers, right? So you've got this problem where you've gone, you know, agencies going, righto, you know, Coca-Cola, you know, we're going to go put your ad in front of this demographic for this amount of time, blah, 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 blah. And they're just like, okay, how do you measure that? These guys measure that, and they've built a big infrastructure to monitor, measure, and produce those reporting back up to the people who effectively pay for it. And it turns out that, you know, these digital advertising signs are just basically web browsers, and they shit themselves and they break and they don't work and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And they're also quite often now, because they're digital, they're also looking for other data around it, like how many people walk past that thing and all these other stuff where so, like, you think about it and it's complex AF, right? Like you've got to understand the intricacies and complex, but it's also sticky. It's like, once you're in that thing, they're not going anywhere. Like, churn is like zero. This is the unleakiest bucket I've ever seen, and it's growing really quickly. So it's a really interesting thing where Tom, the founder, is just like a bit of a nerd in this space, and he loves it. And, you know, he's got a team of 15. They're spread around the world. You know, another one we've got is a company called Syncio. Syncio synchronized Shopify stores. So quite often, you know, Shopify vendors have a bunch of stores and they kind of don't talk to each other, and they sort of behind the scenes push and pull things around so that it can, you know, move stock around in real time. And like, again, you know, that was interesting. They didn't start, mate. So I met Jimmy at Start, mate, and he was just like, I don't think I want to be VC backed. I'm not forever, but just not yet. You know, and again, you know, he's got thousands and thousands of customers because he's a Shopify plugin, right? So he's got this massive amount of customers who are all paying whatever, 50 or 100 bucks a month, some really big names. But he's also like, you know, I'm a Shopify plugin. Like, are Shopify plugins venture back? I don't know, maybe, you know, but right now he's like, I just need to get it to the point. And he's doing millions and millions and millions of dollars a year in revenue, you know, owned almost entirely by Jimmy himself with a couple of mates that put some money in. So, you know, like, anyone would argue that these companies are great companies. They're solid. The customers love them. They've got low churn. They've got high growth, or, you know, they've got high enough growth. They've got high enough growth to sustain, you know, an RBF product. But do they have enough growth to excite, you know, a high growth venture investor that's got opportunity costs in front of them? So, yeah. So, you know, we do a bunch of stuff that looks a little like an outlier. And some people might go, they look a little bit, you know, uninteresting. I'm like, maybe. But the thing about, you know, growing at 100% year and year instead of maybe 300% year and year, if time becomes your friend, if you let that compounding go, right? But you can't look at it over a really short lens and go, oh, you're doing 300% year on year for 3 years and we're going to be squillions. It's like, let's just keep going, right? And these guys are all, the way we describe
it, sustainable growth too, you know? It's very sustainable growth, you know? You're not, the wheels probably aren't going to fall off, you know? I like to use the analogy of Athena. We're growing fast, and I like the wheels to be wobbling, but you don't want them to ever come close to coming off, you know. So there's probably less wobble in the wheels, but like, you can maintain culture, you know, you have better standards of product development, and like, it's probably not as hectic and messy, and less can go wrong, I feel like, which is a major bonus.
I mean, the way we describe our founders is like, they're ambitious, but they're also cautious. And they got the good layer of frugality, right? Is it like when you're watching, when you don't have a bank account full of millions of dollars, like, those constraints breed frustrating constraints on the other side of the coin as well, right? Which is like, shit, I really want to throw some money at something because I know it works, but I don't have any money to throw at them. Or I'll get money next month when the bills are paid. You know, like, it's like that constant battle between, I want to grow faster, but I don't want to grow too fast. So that, you know, I can't, you know, they don't have the luxury of these sort of red brackets at the bottom of the P&L every month. Like, you just can't, it's not sustainable to have them for too long because they're going to run out of money, right? So, you know, the challenge for founders like that is also that, you know, one of the problems that we need to solve when we deploy, you know, we go and drop $500,000 in someone's bank account, you know, that took their bank account from 100 grand to 600 grand. they don't, it's not that they don't know what to do with it. They're just a little bit cautious. Like they're all excited to have a bank account, have to worry about payroll for a little while they sort of deploy it. Is it like that frugality can be a little bit like an hang on a bit too much? It's like, no, you got to use this money. You got to use this money for growth, but it's calculated rather than, you know, VC is effectively like, can we run enough experiments in a short enough time and hopefully one of them works so that we can run more experiments in a short enough time, you know, raise more money so that we can run more experiments. And that's not really the mechanic these people get to work with.
Yeah. VC money. I heard a stat the other day. I don't know if the stat was true or not, but it was about, I think in the last 2 years or 24 months or whatever, I think 60% of VC money goes to Google and Facebook. Which sounds pretty reasonable to me, you know, like, yeah. Because really it's like a land grab. Like we don't really care what the CAC is. We don't really care what the, you know, cost per click is or whatever. Like we just want bulk clients to take over, you know, market share in the industry. And then we'll figure all the rest of the stuff out. Whereas I actually love revenue-based financing. As I said, we use it, you know, we're not obviously a tractor portfolio company, but we use it and it's been phenomenal for us. And we're at the stage where our strategy is looking like raising, you know, early to mid this year. And that's what works for us. The thing that I really liked about what you said is, you mentioned Jimmy, I think, the founder that you talked about. And you said he went through StartMate, they've got great traction, and they might raise VC money, but maybe just not yet. You know, it's that flexibility that you buy. And what Jimmy will have learned is like, have a little bit of money come in, but you have to be scrappy, you have to be frugal, you know, go and raise. And you've got that skill of, you know how to be profitable, you know how to be frugal, you know how to spend a dollar well. I think they're like key. I find like some of the, there's some players in the space that we're entering, like that are, you know, I see some of these stories of founding to unicorn in 12 months or 18 months or whatever. And it's like pre-seed, seed, series A, series B, series E, or whatever. I think I skipped series C, but like, I feel like giving away all of your equity, you know, taking on so much capital, I don't feel like you build the foundations of a smart, well-run, founder-led business, or you give a lot of that away straight away. And yeah, like everyone wants to be a unicorn, and that's a success for a fund, that's a success for a founder, but like it's not a zero sum like fastest to a billion-dollar game, you know, like business is also a long-term play. You're trying to build something that will sustain and will last and will be great long into the future. And I feel like what you do buys people that ability in a much smarter way.
One of the words we love is optionality, right? So the minute that you know, those people you described about like strapping on that, you know, that rocket so quickly, at no point in time can they go, it looks like we've got a really good, you know, at no point in time can they slow down, right? Like you can't launch the rock and go, change your mind. I'll land it over here and turn into a tractor, right? Like that. You cannot I mean, you can take do it, off. But you're gonna have some very disappointed investors, right? Because you've basically sold this massive dream, and everyone's backed that dream, and you just don't have that choice. Now that's okay. Like it's okay for some people to go, we are absolutely burning this capital like crazy so that we can acquire all the things, so that we can, you know, we'll figure out some of the unit metrics and make sure this thing can actually be a solid business down the track. It's like when you do that, if you do that up front, if you know that works, and the problem with that is it's a constant variable, right? Like it's not the same, you know, your CAC and your LTV is changing all the time, especially if you are throwing money at ads. Like that shit is not a, you know, whatever you bought a customer for last month doesn't mean you can get it for this month, right? So you need to be on top of all those mechanics on how it all works. But you know, optionality, you know, so at some point in time, the interesting thing here is that, and something that drives me is like founder wealth. Like, so these founders have put years and years and years into their company and they've got investors, right? Where they got, you know, they might have no investors, they might have some angel investors, and then they take VC investors, right? So the problem, the thing that founders really need to be conscious of is that, you know, the business model of the money you take dictates your definition of success once you take it. Right. So you've taken RBF, we've taken RBF. RBF, the business pays for the loan and the interest, and the long-term value is retained by the shareholders, right? Because you haven't sold any shares, or you may have given a little bit of them to us, but we've worked for them and earned them. But the short answer is that you know, you've taken our RBF loan and given us 1%. Otherwise, you would have sold 25% to the investors for a similar amount of money or a fraction thereof, right? With equity, you don't have to, you know, the company doesn't pay for it. The founder pays for it and they pay for it later. And they usually pay for it in an order of magnitude, right? Yes, they've made a shitload of money too, but the people have also made a shitload. That's the business model, right? The business model is RBF says, we'll give you this $500,000. You're going to give us back 750 over the next couple of years. But you get to retain all the value you used to create that. You know, VC is, you know, we'll give you 500 grand and it'll give us 10% of your company. And then you don't have to pay us back. But when you do pay us back, it's going to be 5 million or 50 million. Yes, you're going to get a lot too, but you know, it's likely the founder's portion is going to go down and down and over time. Hopefully the value is going up and up and up. And you know, it's just like, once you've set that rocket in motion, it's really hard to sort of go, you know, record scratch, come back. Actually, I want to do this over here now. It's just very rare you get to pull that shit off, especially if you're too far down the thing. So, you know, my conversation we have with founders all day long is that, like, if you take this, others have capital, are you absolutely sure that that's the life you want to live? That's, you know, that's the expectations that you're going to deliver? You know, if your answer is, I'm not sure, then maybe you can delay the conversation for 12 months as you grow the business and you get a little bit more confidence. Or at the end of that 12 months, you've still got the optionality to go, actually, I've spent this money, I've grown the business, but it was still at a sustainable rather than rocket pace. I still think that if I take the rocket money, I'm not 100% sure. I'm not sure enough that we'll achieve the growth that the money expects. And, you know, the challenge you've got in startup land is that most startups don't die because they can't raise money. They die because they can't raise more money, right? So it's like, you got the first one away. Excellent. Excellent story. There's no numbers. Everyone's like, yep, you guys are fucking tops. Go for it.
Heaps of PR.
Heaps of PR. You know, you've sold,
The dream. Yeah.
You've sold the dream. You got no numbers. And at some point in time, people are like, yeah, well, show me the numbers. And if the numbers aren't where they need to be, that's where people are just like, whoa, and the opportunity cost for the investors come along and go, you know, like, this other one over here that's doing 400X and you're doing 100X, you know, like, that's not really, you know, that's not where I'm at. So I just think that, you know, there's not a lot of businesses that can actually, no matter how much money you throw at it, can grow. Like, so Sea-Doo, it's very difficult to grow any quicker than the industry allows it to grow, right? You know, they've got enterprise sales. They've got, you know, they've got these slow moving customers, but when they go, yep, we're in, there's like step change in revenue, you know, like sticky long-term contracts, all this kind of stuff. It's like, VC is like, oh, that's a bit slow and boring, isn't it? You're like, I don't know, you know, like a multi-million, multi-year contract, slow and boring. I don't think so, but you might, you know.
Yeah, I love it. I think it just provides, like you said, an option for founders to control their destiny a little bit more, really is the key, you know. And if you want to be on that rocket ship, you want to take the blue pill, fine. You want to take the red pill, you know, we got that over here too. So, and it's just great to see something more bespoke in Australia, you know, to like have a support mechanism that you guys would provide. It's rad.
Hey, let me tell you something interesting about hiring. Right now, it sucks. It's hard. It's also expensive, but it doesn't have to be. If you hire remotely with Athena, you'll skip the hurdles of having spectacular people on your team. And no, you'll pay far less than you think. We save businesses like yours up to 70% of typical hiring costs. That's up to 80 grand per account executive person per year. You could use that leftover cashola to scale. What are you waiting for? Head over to www.athena.io/rare to learn more. That's www.athyma.io/rare.
Hey, I want to move to, like, I guess more of your putting your advisory and your investor hat on in some of the StartMate stuff. You know, your investor in, you know, Mr. Yum and Linktree and some of these really exciting startups. Spaceship as well. I'm a spaceship user. Love Spaceship. Except it's been plummeting through the floor at the moment. And every day, me and my partner wake up, we check it. We're not happy. But that's tech stocks at the moment. And, you know, nothing against Spaceship. It's just. But Matt, I wanted to ask. So in your you know, history as an advisor and an investor and an angel and so forth, what are some of the best startups have in common? Is there any threads that you can kind of point out that's like, I love seeing that. That will normally be a key indicator of future success.
Yeah, it's interesting because as I get older, I realize that, you know, a lot of founders and companies, therefore, but founders specifically, almost live in two diametrically opposed states at any point in time. Like, they are extremely confident about some things and extremely not confident about other things. And the balance between the two shifts over time. So, you know, and the confidence on the, you know, the things they're not confident on, their ability to, you know, run egoless experiments, you know. And one thing we talk about at Tractor a lot internally is, like, even though Tractor is sort of built off my idea, is like, I don't have monopoly on anything. Like, I try and leave my ego at the door every day. And if someone comes up with a better anything, let's do it. You know, we're talking this week in our strategy stuff about, you know, really sort of tightening in our vision and mission. And like, I put my version up, but like, if someone else got a better version, so be it. So I think founders who are open, you know, it's almost that, like, strong opinions loosely held, right? And I think people get in trouble when they have the strong opinion strongly held, right? Like, a strong, and there's like, they're getting new information's coming in, and they're not even able to respond to it, you know, like, not having a mindset where they go, you know, it's clear to me that this new information dictates that what we're doing is not working. And that can be a challenge, right? And that can manifest in lots of different ways about behavioral traits of founders, you know, response to questioning. You know, I like founders that when you question, you know, you question them, it's not an attack. Like, it's like, you know, you're coming best intent.
Thank you for coming at it from the other angle and highlighting something for me.
Yeah. And it's, thank, I mean, like, as an advisor, you know, my job is to kind of just ask questions. You know, I've probably got an opinion, but it's not necessarily to dump it on them. It's to sort of ask enough questions so that, you know, they answer their own question. It could be that they land where mine landed, or the questioning itself took them on a different journey. So I think that the ability to sort of listen and also, like, trust, I think that's a real killer. Like, founders that don't trust their people, that don't trust their employees, I think more startups die because founders can't let go of stuff, rather than the opposite, where they're not interested and they you know, they're like, too much a founder in the weeds. That governing factor of growth is quite often, especially early, is a founder in the weeds that can't get themselves out. You know, they can't bring themselves to the abstraction layer that a founder CEO needs to be. Now, obviously, when it's two people, you've got a shitload of stuff to do. But at a certain point in time, you know, my team's 14 now. And, you know, I'm basically come to the conclusion that everybody can do sort of one or two things well. And we just pay the other people to do their one or two things well. And that's it, right? It's when people are doing 10 things in a shitty way and the founder's also doing 10 things and eight of them are like substandard and they're not being delivered on and they're taking too long and whatever. It's like, if you can't solve, like, the problem as a founder to solve is almost like that you got to solve your own problem first. Like, you need to go, you need to identify that you're doing this shit that I'm not good at. And I need to, you know, to do that, you need to be able to say, I'm not good at a whole bunch of shit. And like, I think that's an ego thing, right? If you can move that to the side and go, like, my default position is that I'm shit at most things and I'm good at a couple of things. And I say to my whole crew, it's like, you're probably shit at most things, but you're good at a couple of things. And if you find yourself,
that's not offensive. That's not offensive either. It's just a human being.
It shouldn't be. Like, it's because, you know, like, a lot of people will dwell on the, hey, he just said I was shit at a bunch of stuff. But actually, they should be going, actually, no, but the two things that I'm really good at are the things that when I'm doing those things, it's effortless. Like, it's just like everybody's moving and everyone's in sync and it feels fucking great. It's when, and I know when I get out of my lane, and for me, I'm not a details guy. You know, ironically, as 15 years a software developer where software is all about details, I'm not a details
guy. Self-taught software developer. Self-taught.
Yeah, I taught myself enough to get the job done and enough for people to make a lot of money off it, but not enough to be, you know, I never thought of it as my craft, you know. And I think a lot of founders, you know, believe everything is their craft, you know. And it's funny, you hear founders talk about, oh, this startup's my baby. And I'm like, oh, you know, like, you're gonna have to do some nasty shit to that baby. Like, you know,
you're gonna have to kill that baby.
Yeah, 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 well, you might have to slap it around a little bit.
You might have to blow your baby up.
Exactly.
Sell your baby to someone else.
Yeah, you're like, and your baby's ugly. Sorry.
Someone might fuck your baby. Oh, that last one went too far.
And I think it's a fascinating thing, and it's something that I reflect on a lot as a you know, I've founded several companies before. You know, I see Tractor as, and I actually asked this on Twitter the other day, it's like, can you build a really successful company when you're not, you know, so emotional that things my baby, and you know, you're so wrapped up in this thing. And you know, I feel like I'm rational about this stuff. Like we know what we need to do. I know where our gaps are. I know what success looks like. And I know I've got a fairly good plan that a lot of people have backed me to go and execute on. But this is not my baby. This is not like, if someone comes in and says, that's fucking stupid, I'm like, cool, tell me why. You know, a lot of founders would run the other direction and go, no, it's not, it's great. I'm like, are you sure? So I think that, you know, coming back to your question about what does successful founders do, I think it's the ability to be, so the conclusion of that sort of interesting Twitter thread was like, be emotional about that mission and vision and be really rational about how you get there, right? Be really rational about the inputs that are changing constantly, that you need to pivot and move things around and kill certain parts of the baby, chop its arm off and put a new one on because it wasn't working, to the point where, you know, like I am passionate about helping different shaped founders create their definition of successful business, right? And their definition, not the funder's definition, their definition. That's what I can, you know, you guys know me, like I can talk about that shit all day long. How we do that is I trust my team to figure out, you know, how we create financial products that help them, how we create advisory that help them, how we price those things, how we structure the risk attached to them. Like, it's not that I don't care. It's just that it's not my forte. And if it was, that'd be frustrating because I can't oscillate from being this dude up here who's sort of, you know, trying to tell every founder that they should understand their options, and then going, you know, that decimal place is off by one, and I, you know, that's just not who I am. So, and it's interesting because a lot of founders are a product, like they're the core, they're the expert in their domain, and you know, they are probably the best of the best, which is why they can be, they've created this startup around them. But unless they can elevate themselves to be the leader they need to be and hand off some of that sort of operational stuff, they're going to be the governor. You know, they're going to be the red line. Like the whole company's going to bounce off and it's never going to be able to accelerate change to the next year.
You're the bottleneck at some point.
Yeah, they become the bottleneck.
I tell you what it feels like for me. I'm in a nice position with Athena now where I have excellent leaders around me that are much better than me in pretty much every department. We're still on the hunt for our head of product. We've had a couple of goes at it and didn't find the right person, so we kind of withdrew. But for me, it kind of feels like, you know, public speaking or doing something really scary for the first time. So what I mean by that is like, oh my God, I couldn't get up there and speak on stage. And then the first time you go up and you public speak, you're like, oh, that was nowhere near as bad as what I thought it was. And giving up, you know, responsibility at Athena, I feel like for me, it's the scariest thing in the world until you get like a month down the track and then you go, oh, thank fuck for that. You know, like it's a massive relief. It's that huge weight off your shoulders and then you can go and do something more. Whatever the next thing you need to learn is, you know, because there's always the next thing that you need to learn as you go up the, I guess, on the journey, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. It's, it gets really, but again, like I like to bubble all this down like to your, you know, ego, which has sort of got, you know, my favorite book is Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday. You know, he talks about your ego. There's sort of these three phases. The ego is fighting against you all the time. So as you're ascending, it's telling you negative stories about how you can't, you know, you won't be able to do that. And, you know, all the signals are around how you won't be able to achieve what you're trying to achieve. Once you actually get up there and you are doing stuff, it's trying to, you know, to plant the negative shit and work against you to sort of bring you back down again. And inevitably you will come down. And once you're down, it's sort of, you know, like I told you so kind of stuff. So our ability to you know, acknowledge the fact that what you just said, Bill, around, you know, I can't do that. You know, like the self-limiting of I can't do that is like, Like the minute you go, actually, you know, it's just for, it's, you know, my fucking dumb lizard brain tell me I can't do that. And yeah, it's scary. But I think the difference between being scared and being fearful is really interesting as a founder. Like fear just stops progress, right? You become fearful and shit comes to a grinding halt. Being scared, in my mind, scared and excited is the exact same thing. You just got to put a different label on it. And that's a very conscious decision a lot of times. Very consciously go, I'm fucking scared to hand this thing over, but I'm also excited to. Like you just said, I'm, you know, I need a head of product. When I get one, I'm really scared that they're not going to be able to do it as good as we've done it up until now, or that they'll take it on a different path. But I'm actually excited from the fact that that's no longer my responsibility and I can go do other stuff. And, you know, the oscillation between those two states is kind of, you know, instantaneous. You know, like you'll, as I said initially, you'll be in both states at the same time. And like knowing which one to sort of put the label on and knowing which one to go, that's how actually it's this right now. And yeah, look, I am scared, but I'm also, you know, excited. But, you know, it's that fear, like, I think like fear crushes progression. Like it really just, everything comes to a grinding halt and you're like, I don't know what to do. And it really can't do it. So I'm so afraid of what's about to happen.
I heard something awesome I'm doing some ketamine assisted therapy in San Diego at the moment for like mental health and anxiety, pretty much. It's super interesting stuff. That's like a whole podcast worth of another story. But the therapist there, her name's Simone. And she was talking about anxiety and she's like, hey, I get anxiety all the time. I said, oh yeah, cool. Like, what's your history like? She goes, I battle with it. She goes, the way that I move out the door and go to that event, or the way that I, you know, hand over that paper, or the way that I, whatever it is that she's anxious about. She goes, I've just got this rule within myself that I'm happy to do things scared. You know, I'm happy to rock up to that event and be scared, you know, be scared, feel shit, feel I'm scared right now. And I'm scared because this is the reason, but I'm going to do things scared. I'm not going to let the fact that I'm scared actually stop me from doing the things that I want to do in my life. And when she said that, I was like, fuck, that's pretty unreal. That's it really just, because you can apply it to anything. Just like what you just said then, it's like, you know, life is scary in a lot of ways, but it doesn't mean that you should limit yourself and the life that you live because you're a little bit scared.
Oh, do you want to hear my ketamine story?
Oh, I love a good ketamine story.
So when I was at Amazon,
it's an Amazon ketamine story. This will be the clip for LinkedIn, I reckon.
My boss Ian Gardner and I ran the first event called Venture Down Under, which was we took all the VCs to Queenstown in Queensland, in New Zealand. So we organised this trip away. Like they paid for it, but we just like put on this ball a couple of days where there was a bunch of like really like great conversations around the VCs, and it was really amazing. And then on Saturday it was like, you want to go heli skiing, you want to go skiing, you want to go, like, there's all these like hardcore events. And I'm like, I'm not a boarder, I'm not a skier, I'm a shit skier. Ian like has a house in Aspen, he's literally there right now, skis all the time. So he's like, we're gonna go skiing, and VC's like skiing. I'm like, okay, fine. So I went snowboarding, which I've done once before, terribly. Anyway, I managed to sort of get going, it was all right. And then I was coming down the hill, I went to turn poorly and I landed and dislocated my elbow. So my right arm went 90 degrees the wrong direction.
Oh,
and
God.
Crunch. So on the ski hill, so I'm like, fuck. So they, you know, they ski down, they put me in a little sled, they take me to the on the mountain, they're like, looks like it's just disconnected. So I had morphine, I had three times a year. I had the whistle thing, the green whistle thing you have at the dentist. I had morphine and they doped me up on ketamine. And they put my arm back in, right? They put my arm back in on the mountain, but they're like, here, have some of this shit. And there's video evidence of me offering, you know, the paramedics $100,000 worth of Amazon cloud credits. You know, and my team who were on the mountain with me are like, all right, we're going to come with you and make sure you're okay. And there's, I'm just like, absolutely fucking gone down a K-hole.
God.
And while my arm was 90 degrees the wrong direction, and they fixed it, and then we went down the mountain.
We got to get mad on ketamine more often. This is classic.
And then we went down the mountain in the most rickety, you know, ambulance thing, bumpy, and it was fine. You know, and my elbow's like flapping around, and then, you know, got x-rayed, it was fine. And I was back at dinner with everyone like that night, and they're like,
oh, really?
You. Yeah.
Whoa, that's so anyway, crazy.
Ketamine story.
Yeah, it's actually super, super, it's a crazy experience, but yeah, like I said, it's probably another story for another day. So what are the most exciting things in the Aussie tech scene for you, Matt? So, like, obviously Traktor, if there's things that you're seeing there, or like, I know you're an investor in some of the most exciting startups, I would say, that are kind of around right now. What are you seeing in the industry around, you know, Asia Pacific that's just got you fired up?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, I'm excited to think that, I think VC in Australia is finally getting to the point where they're actually backing proper VC risks, you know, like big rounds, big companies, big expectations. I think up until like their risk appetite has been a lot of capital, not much venture. You know, that's not always true, but you know, there's a lot of things where a lot of VCs, and the irony is, of course, Traktor is exactly enforcing that negative stereotype, which is, you know, we want to see traction, we want to see revenue, we want to see whatever. And you know, VC is more like, yeah, I got this crazy idea, let's go. So, you know, if you are a founder who effectively can tell a great story, you know, you are likely to be able to get this stuff away. And I think that, you know, Mr. Yum, Linktree, good examples of things that, you know, global things that can go bananas straight away. And, you know, optimizing for, you know, Mr. Yum's a good example of sitting in the nexus between, you know, people did a bunch of this work, you know, HOSPO people, like HOSPO, very few countries of the world, unless maybe France, like HOSPO is not a career. It's a thing you do while you're waiting for the other thing you actually want to do. So you've got this transient cost base, you know, as a HOSPO owner, you know, you've got this unreliable sometimes workforce, and especially in Australia post COVID, all the international people pissed off. So, you know, that I got a lot of my, some of my investors run some of the best pubs in Melbourne, and they're just like, we can't, like, this is really hard. So these platforms that can come in and actually do some of the grind, you know, do some of that, you know, enhance their workforce and take some of the repetitive, consistent processes off them, give a really good user experience, and then scale like crazy because the barrier to entry is really low. Like, that's exciting. That's really exciting to think that there's these big businesses that are built by a team, you know, two blocks away from here in Melbourne, is pretty exciting. I chair a company. So, you know, not I've got, April, I have about 50 angel investments, but I chair a company as well called Qzik, and we stream the audio over IP into Macca's and 7-Eleven and VWS and you know, around the world. So we have IP-based speakers everywhere, and we can do some amazing stuff with messaging around, you know, helping these people, helping our customers talk to their customers, you know, and we can measure the impact it has around the impact on sales, the impact on all kinds of stuff. We can adjust the music, adjust the messaging in real time. And that, like, as coming out of COVID, where nobody's been able to go in and have a good retail experience, like, people are thinking about how do we enhance IRL, right? You know, like, IRL is, you know, like, people are probably going to, the habits we formed in lockdown about buying staples and boring shit is probably going to exist to the point where nobody really wants to, you know, do that as a thing. But if the environments were less icky, you know, and were more, you know, more interesting, like maybe they will. So, you know, we got a bunch of customers there, and that company has just gone bananas, and I'm really excited to be able to help companies like that. And yeah, thinking about that retail experience, it's like, you know, people are like, it's dead. Well, I don't think it's dead. I think it's going to be more important than ever for it to be really interesting rather than bland.
Yeah, unreal. Look, Before we get you out of here, I want to throw it over to Wilo, who's got a couple of quick rapid fire questions that we do every week. So over to you, and he will not sing them. He will they're just straight regular.
I will try to not sing them. I will try. I had so many questions, but you answered them before I could ask. So it was like, yeah, let me just learn from the bosses. Yeah. So my first question is, what is one tool you cannot live without? For reference, someone said their cell phone, another person said breakfast. You can say
yeah, right. For me now, it's a combination. It's two things actually, and they're both exercise related. So my push bike. So I cycle to work, and it sort of gives me that really good break between, you know, going to the office and then going. It's only 3 kilometers from home. It only takes about 7 minutes, but I do take the long way. And another thing I've got is a thing called a Vitruvian Form, which is an IoT weightlifting device that I absolutely love. So every morning, I put up on my TV. It's in my lounge room. I can lift up to 200 kilos, which I can't lift 200 kilos, but I'm incrementally getting better.
So 200 kilos?
I can do 100, but not 200. So those two things for me are like those tools are the things I use to anchor the beginning of my day. You know, so it's so really important to me to do that throughout the work week.
Awesome. Thank you. And my second question, what is your favorite book right now? Right. Recently.
So right now. I read the same book in the Christmas holidays every year for the last 3 years, and it's Atomic Habits. So
I have that right there.
Yeah. Cracker. I listen to it at fast speeds while I'm riding a lot of the time. And it just reminds me that you know, the biggest takeaway for me from that book when I first read it was, you know, it's easier to change the environment. Like you change your environment, then you can go and build a new thing. So, you know, in COVID, in the last lockdown here in Melbourne, I was coming to basically an empty office because the environment at home was stopping me getting work done. You know, it was too close to the couch. It was the bad habits. It was bad habit stacking was off the chart. So I had to like do a hard break and go, actually over here is how I get work done. So, you know, and an interesting takeaway there is, I eat too fast and I realize it's a negative habit stack. Like I'm consciously trying to unpick a 44 year old habit here, to try wow. and slow down my consumption of food. And you know, like I'll finish my food. My family are like on second bite and I sit around for an hour while they finish and like, this is tedious. So like, how do I fix that? So, yeah, you know, and I think, it's literally like this hoover up everything. So Atomic Habits is my absolute favorite book for both not only creating positive ones but identifying them.
Yeah, and my final question, what do you have any advice for entrepreneurs out there, you know, trying to I guess pitch to investors of any sort? I guess,
yeah, look, being a really good storyteller and be able to, you know, talk about the future, being able to talk about the future as a fad that doesn't exist as a founder, it's really difficult for people that find it hard to embellish, find it very hard to basically not talk about things that are real because they're not real yet. You know, there's a cynical twist on this is that you have to lie a little bit. It's not that you have to lie a little bit. It's that you have to be convinced that what you're talking about will be true. And without that, you won't raise a cent. Like nobody will back you unless you believe that the future state you're talking about will be true. And it's really hard to even convince yourself. Like you can pitch really badly because it's clear that you don't believe that to be true. So you need to find a way to get the future state you're talking about to be very true in internally to you. Otherwise no one will buy it.
Yeah, confidence is contagious. Thank you. Let me pass it back to Dr. Finish Off Bill Kerr.
Matt, where can people find you? Anything you want to plug, you know, websites, reaching out, anything in terms of that?
Yeah, so personally on Twitter at Matt Allen is probably where I'm most active. If you head over to tractiveventures.com, we'd love to talk to any founders who are considering, you know, the next phase of growth for their company and would like to have hopefully as non-biased as possible view on some options for them. My team is really good at explaining to them, you know, the implications of the decision they're about to make and the kind of people you might want around them. So tractiveventures.com and Matt Allen on Twitter is probably best.
Awesome. Unreal. Well, that's pretty much all there is from our end, Matt. Really appreciate your time, mate. Super awesome to hear from somebody with, you know, such a vast array of experience like yourself. And just excited for the future of Tractor. And the team. So that's it from us.
Thanks for having me. It was a really great conversation. Talk to you all soon.
Cool. And that's a wrap.
That's all for now, mateys. I found this conversation just awe-inspiring. Matt had me nearly speechless with everything he knows and what he's doing with Tractor Ventures. Thanks for listening to the end, and a huge thanks to the legendary Matt Allen for immersing us in all his wisdom. If you enjoy our podcast, please support us by sharing your favorite episodes and subscribing on our YouTube, listening on Spotify, and every podcast platform available on the bloody planet. It's season 2, damn it. Too Rare to Live, Too Rare to Die is supported by Athena, co-produced by Matthias Rosenberg and Celeste Bono, creative direction by Josefina Cordova, and hosted by Bill Kerr and me, Uwalo Olapoju. Peace.
So you just got funding and you're excited to grow. You're gonna need people, great people, but not so fast. Finding them will be very difficult. Hiring them will be pretty costly, and paying them will be your biggest expense. After all, a strong team will build an epic business. Yep. But what if I told you you can save 2/3 of those hiring costs by employing global staff? Think of all that runway money you can save. We'll find the talent you're looking for and hire them too. Go to www.athena.io/rare right now to learn more. That's www.athyna.io/rare right now.